Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Jim Gaffigan may not still completely understand what's happened to him. In a flash, it seems, he's gone from being very comfortable with the idea of being the weird uncle that went out and did stand-up every night to being a former loner with a wife and five kids, all under age eight, all living in a two-bedroom apartment in New York. It's like, Jim writes, that I left some peanut butter out overnight. Jim Gaffigan is one of this country's best-known comedians, and it's humor that you can pretty much expose your kids to. His new book only adds another big element to his routine because it's a report from the front lines of parenthood, and it's a pretty hilarious one at that. The book's title, Dad is Fat, which happens to be the first words out of his son's mouth, and it also happens to be number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list this week. Jim Gaffigan appears in town tonight. More on that in a moment. Let's get Jim on everybody's map this morning. Here he is in one of his more famous routines, talking about Hot Pockets.
Never really see that on a menu when you go out to dinner. You know, let's see, I'll have the Caesar salad and the Hot Pocket. Tonight's specials, we have a sea bass, which is broiled, and we have a hot pocket, which is cooked in a dirty microwave. And that comes with a side of Pepto. Is your hot pocket cold in the middle? It's frozen. But it can be served boiling lava hot. Will it burn my mouth? It'll destroy your mouth. Everything will taste like rubber for a month. I'll have the hot pocket.
Jim Gaffigan, welcome to Kansas City. Welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you're pretty well known as a Hot Pockets guy. How does that work for you these days?
Well, it's a blessing and a curse, right? I mean, it's allowed me to tour the country doing theaters, but I certainly don't need more drunk 20-year-olds yelling it at me on Friday night.
That's I was going to say, how often does that happen these
days?
A lot.
A lot of airport yelling Hot Pockets, too.
You know, there's Hot Pockets, and there's also a riff you do on McDonald's and how people show up there even though they know they shouldn't. I guess the common thread there is food, Jim. Why so much focus on food?
Well, I write about what I love. But there's also, I think it's important, at least for me, I wanted my material to have a universal appeal. I didn't want to just talk to a small segment of the audience. I wanted everyone in the room to feel comfortable with the topic, and I wouldn't have to over-explain what I was discussing.
You know, the book is titled Dad is Fat, but you're not fat.
I know. Tell my son that.
I'm checking you out here a little bit. You're not fat.
But in my son's eyes, I'm fat and bald. But I am kind of fat. And in a way, I think some people should be fat. I mean, we all have that friend that's lost tons of weight. And when you see him, you kind of think, you look better fat.
You know, making a life in comedy just strikes me as such a crapshoot. How satisfied are you with where you're at these days? Because you've got to be feeling pretty good.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing thing. It is absolutely a crapshoot. And I feel very fortunate that I'm making a living and I can afford to have children. I don't know. I didn't expect to be in this position. I'm very grateful.
Where did the humor come from in your family?
I think I'm the youngest of six
kids.
Yes,
you are.
Which does not prepare you to be a parent. But I think there's a certain amount of trying to get attention. But I think I also wanted to add an adjective before pale. You know, I'm a pale kid, and I wanted to be maybe the funny pale kid.
Mm-hmm. Just something to break yourself out of the mold here a little bit.
Yeah, you know, people want to, you know, we want to seek our own identities, so I think.
Well, your humor certainly didn't come from your dad. You once said of him, and this is a quote, "My father's size was not overwhelming, but his presence was enormous. He could shake out a room with a never-ending pause. He could cut my knees out with his evil eye. I could feel the vibrations from him walking on those heavy heels, smell his cigarette in the air, and suddenly fear would fill my stomach."
Yeah, it sounds pretty terrifying.
It sounds kind of terrifying.
Well, you know, to be fair, he certainly wasn't a monster. I hear that and I feel guilty. But he was a very intimidating figure, and he was the first in his family to go to college, and so he was motivated by discipline. He was a dad of a different era. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. My dad was intimidating, but he was definitely, I think he did all right.
And you're a different kind of dad, it sounds like.
Well, I think most dads, I don't know about your situation.
You're looking at me. You're looking at one here. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, our fathers had a different role. You know, there's my dad, you know, really essentially all he did was bring home the bacon, and that did not mean he would shop for the bacon or even bring it home or cook it. He would just eat the bacon. But of course, who wouldn't? But the amazing thing about my father's generation is not that he didn't do anything. It's that he didn't feel guilty at all. And I'm a pretty involved father, and I do all these things. I have a summer sling for a baby and a winter sling for my baby, and I still feel guilty.
Yeah, what is it about guilt and parenthood these days? Because you're talking to I feel much the same way often.
It's a strange thing, the guilt, right? Because
yeah.
You feel guilty at all different moments because it's an improbable task pulling off parenting in a manner where you can do it properly. So I think when you're a parent, you know from experience, having had parents, that the likelihood of you doing it perfectly is impossible. So any task where you're doing it wrong feels awkward.
Yeah, there's all this talk about parenting these days, too, about, you know, we're way overdoing it. We're way too involved. We're helicopter parenting because you're so right. The way you parent, and I think the way I parent, is so different than the way my parents did it. It's a whole new paradigm, and you sort of sit back and wonder sometimes, are we doing it the right way or not?
Yeah, well, I think my point of view in my book is I have no idea what I'm doing. I mean, I was very late to the parenting game. You know, I was in my early 30s, still single. I didn't think I'd get married. And now I have 5 kids. So I didn't think that I would be good at parenting. And, you know, obviously I try very hard, but it's an impossible task. And I think being a dad is really difficult because we are we are the vice presidents of the parental executive branch.
I was just looking for my note there where you do write about this idea that compared to your wife, you do sort of hang back and she's the general and the commander and the captain all wrapped up into one, and there you are.
And we're supposed to order the pizza, right? I mean, I know that sounds – obviously there are men that don't fit this mold. I'm talking about me personally, but I really – you know, it's very strange. I'm a very ambitious, motivated, hardworking person. But when it comes to being a father, I feel as though my instincts are not there. You know, I've been, you know, programmed, you know, almost kind of like a biological sense to look out for moi.
Yeah.
So it's strange the fatherhood thing.
Yeah. So many times, even with my sons who were with me in the studio this morning, along with Aaron Branch, big fans of Jim Gaffigan. You know, something comes up with the kids and I invariably look at my wife and sort of like, now what? How do we respond to this? Please tell me.
Right. Yeah. You know? I think there's something instinctive that mothers have, and maybe it's because they're carrying the babies for 9 months, but I mean, obviously you love your children with all your heart, but there's just something instinctive where you're like, I don't know, what should we do? Should we, you know, and I think the go-to is to be the strict, stern dad, to be the, you know, if we're vice presidents, it's to be the Dick Cheney, right?
Yeah. Jim Gaffigan is our guest, the great comedian. He'll speak tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. The event is sponsored by Rainy Day Books in Fairway in our neighborhood. For tickets, call the store at 913-384-3126. So what did happen to you? I want to run these numbers by our listeners again. There's lots of numbers here, Jim, that are so important to you. You and your wife, that's two people, have 5 kids, all under the age of 8, all living in a count-em 2-bedroom apartment in New York. I'm struggling here. That's a whole lot of numbers.
Yeah.
What does that all add up to?
Here's another number. It's a 5-story walk-up. All the numbers add up to me not being that bright.
Yeah.
But the reality is obviously I love it. And, you know, I'm sure like you, it's – the best – adjective I have is dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so But I think I don't know what happened. In a way, it's you know, in the book I talk about it's a little bit like that frog in the boiling water where the heat's turned up. It's, you know, these five kids didn't just show up at one time. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened, but it's something that I really I don't know. There's an element that I cherish, but there's also a part of parenting that is so overwhelming that you just kind of go with it,
yeah,
right?
You
make good decisions as you can,
as
hopefully.
As best you can, yeah. Right. I love this line from your book. 10 years ago, I could barely get a date, and now my apartment is literally crawling with babies. It's like I left some peanut butter out overnight.
Yeah. It's very much true. I just, you know, I was somebody, I wasn't a huge fan of children. I mean, that's not to say that, I don't really like humans in general, but it's not as if I was like a camp counselor or a babysitter ever. You know, my exposure to children was when Raven Simone was added to the Cosby Show. I really didn't, they were foreign. And I was a mediocre uncle. And but I love it. I know I keep saying that.
Well, was there a moment for you, Jim? I mean, you got married. Was your wife saying, by George, we're going to have kids. We're going to have kids starting tomorrow. Or how did all of this sort of come across your life like this?
Well, I come from a large family. My wife's one of nine. She's the oldest.
Well,
of nine.
Both of you sort of didn't have a fighting chance here in a way.
Yeah. But there is something, and there was a romantic notion. Like when I met my wife, I jokingly said, we had an awkward exchange, and I jokingly said, we're probably going to get married. And then as a joke, I had said to her, we're probably going to have six kids, like on our third date. And so there is something. I mean, I'm Catholic. My wife is very Catholic. She's a Shiite Catholic. So there is some playing without a goalie. But there is an openness that, I feel very – like if my wife told me she was pregnant, I wouldn't be surprised because she tells me that every year. But there is something about it where I'd be fine with it. I'd be happy. You know, I say, each of my children has made me a better person, based on that, I only need another 34 to be a decent guy. But I don't know. There's something strange about being a dad that it's the most important thing we'll do, right?
Well, when you went through this transition, and I was an older father myself, and when you went through this transition from being single guy and you're focused on your stand-up routine, you're traveling the country, to suddenly being sort of tethered to a home, and how did that work for you? Was it a struggle or not really? Or
well, it was interesting. I mean, I've always been driven. A desire for security replaces ambition. It is a big shift for a dad, I think.
Yeah.
Where you're not motivated by but I don't know, it doesn't feel very strange. It feels like, not to sound corny, it's a very abundant universe.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I know there's horrible things happening all the time and I'm very lucky, but I do feel like, it's all gonna work out if you're making good decisions. And I make mistakes all the time. I mean, when I was writing this book, I told myself, by the way, I wrote everything in the book with my wife. I don't want people to think that I just did this by myself.
And she's a comedian too,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, she's my writer. She's my comedy writer. Mm-hmm. And we write everything together, my partner and everything. But when I was writing this book, I did not want to do a book that was, I hate my kids. And I didn't want to do a book that was I love my children and Jesus. So I wanted to find a balance there.
Uh-huh.
And the point of view I really came to is that I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm an observational comedian who had five opportunities to see how little I do know. And my comedy is constructed on my point of view. So my point of view is this befuddled kind of semi-selfish guy, mm-hmm. and how I've adjusted to this desire to really be a good dad.
Jim Gaffigan is our guest. He's the great comedian. His new book is titled Dad is Fat. You can see him tonight at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Plaza. The event sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. Grab a ticket by calling 913-384-3126. You can talk to Jim right now by giving us a call, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org. You can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. I'm interested in the whole writing process. My son's interested in sort of walking down this road. Aaron Branch has been exploring this for a number of years. You write with your wife? Do you sit down after the kids are in bed, and or are you doing it on the phone, or are you making notes on your phone as you go through your day? And, oh, that's kind of funny, and I'm going to talk about that later. Yeah. How do you approach it all?
Well, my stand-up is very much finding a topic and a point of view associated with that topic, and then trying to get all the meat off the bone, because it always has to be about food with me. So there, and how we work is very much I'll kind of come up with an idea and improvise, talk a little bit about it on stage, rewrite it at home, and then Jeannie will see me do some sets and have some thoughts and maybe have a commentary on whether it's clear, whether I'm communicating something that could be misconstrued, and then, just attacking the topic, whether it be bacon or McDonald's, and we'll just sit there and we'll think of things on that topic.
Well, speaking of McDonald's, let's listen to one of Jim Gaffigan's routines. This one is on one of his frequent visits to McDonald's.
You ever been at McDonald's and you see a friend for a second? You're like, oh, crap. Eventually you're like, hey, what's going on? And they're just like, I'm just here for the 99-cent ATM. What are you doing here, Jim? I'm just meeting a hooker. Certainly not eating here, that's for sure. Yeah, he should be here by now.
Well, this writing process that you go through, is it hard to get the feedback from your wife? Because my wife sometimes edits the stuff that I write, and usually it's okay, but once in a while it's like, I don't want to hear it. You know?
Yeah, there's definitely some combat here and there. But there's, you also know that you can trust them, and they know how you think, and I don't have to worry about like, she can tell me, look, that's just unnecessarily dirty. Mm-hmm. That gets in the way of what we're trying to accomplish. Or she'll say something's not clear. Or she'll have some great comic lines, great comic lines.
I guess comedy is like so many other things in life. People, I imagine, just assume you stand up in front of a crowd and the lines just roll off your tongue effortlessly, and there's an endless bounty of things that you can talk about. But in fact, you're working it, you're going to stand-up nights, you're reworking it, your wife is critiquing you, you're trying to make it clear. I've read about Seinfeld going through very much the same thing. Yeah. It's a real process that you're...
It's really interesting how there is this kind of mythology around stand-up comedy. Whether it be Robin Williams or Jerry Seinfeld, I think people think people just go on stage and they're immediately funny.
Funny.
I mean, there's worse myths. Like, there's some audience members think that if they heckle, they're actually helping. But there's something, and some of the performance of a comedian is keeping it fresh and almost making it appear like they just thought of it. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll see comedians, do kind of like a pause while they'll gaze up and they'll be like, I shouldn't be saying this. And that's all performance. And it's a strange kind of manipulation that comedians do with an audience.
It's acting.
It's acting. It's absolutely acting.
Right, right. And again, it's a lot harder work than most people want to give you credit for a lot of times.
Yeah,
right?
I think there is something about keeping it fresh and living in the moment that is probably what people really enjoy about stand-up. So when you're on a roll and you come up with a line, the audience knows. There's stand-up comedy is very much a conversation with the audience. There's no fourth wall. And so the more fresh and honest and spontaneous it actually is, the more the audience enjoys it.
And I'm just guessing here, early on in your career, there must have been moments when you're wondering, can I do this or not? Do I have the right stuff? Audiences legendarily can be brutal to a young guy and tear you up pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from the Midwest, but I started in New York, and I had I'm a slow talking, white bread looking Midwesterner. And when I was in New York City, you know, the only blonde guy that a lot of these people had seen was John Tesh. So I was not in their sweet spot.
The great John Tesh.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what prompted me to add in talking for the audience. It was, you know, I didn't want to go a moment where I wasn't saying something on stage. And I also wanted to disarm possible heckles.
So for people who don't know, you sort of have a disembodied voice sort of speaking that you do of someone sort of critiquing your routine as you go along.
Yeah. And some of it is that was part of my that was something I used as a teenager in awkward situations. Say if I was late, it was a great way to disarm someone if I came and I was like, Jim, I can't believe you're late. You said you'd be here at 2:30 and you got here at 2:45. So it's an effective tool to disarm people. And so initially I would just do it, and I would do some shows where I would just be speaking for everyone in the audience. And it adds an improv element too, because it's very much in the moment.
Wasn't that your sister's idea? Did I read somewhere?
Well, you know, there's some of it is, you know, I am parroting my sister, who would, you know, kind of have a commentary of like, I think Jimmy needs to go to bed early. But it's a lot of different things. Anyone who has a sibling, you know, you can do a voice of how they would judge you in a situation. Like, I think you should get a book on comedy. You know, like just these inappropriate things said.
Lots of phone calls for Jim Gaffigan, 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us @KCURUpToDate. Courtney from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Courtney.
Hi, everybody. I have a question, Jim. You mentioned that your wife is your partner in everything and is your comedy writer. And I have the same question for all couples who work together, parent together, all of those things. Are you ever tired of each other? Is that ever just too much time together?
I would never be tired of my wife. She might be listening to this.
Yeah.
No, well, of course. But I think you get used to certain things, right? And I shot a pilot for a TV show, and my wife we helped come up with the idea, and she was there, and she gave me acting notes. I don't know. There's something – I understand that it's unusual and it's rare, but it's what I'm used to. And it's – believe me, there's definitely times where I'm like, I don't want any more notes. But it's pretty – maybe it's codependency on my part at this
point. I think there's something about the trust factor that you said a few minutes ago, Jim. That makes complete sense to me. You know you're getting a straight skinny from at least one person who's not just wanting to glom onto you and praise you and love you and all that
stuff. Right, yeah, because I think – I mean, to be perfectly honest, I think that the entertainment industry is very dangerous for the people that go into it, are seeking some ego validation. And often what happens is we get kind of caught up into it. We start believing our own hype, and then, you know, horrible things can happen.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Hey, how do you ward that off?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've made many mistakes, but mostly I try and stay grounded. I mean, I don't really have – I mean, I have five children, so I'm not out at some movie premiere. But you know, the entertainment industry is very strange. I mean, stand-up is unique in that it is probably more of a meritocracy than other aspects, you know, going to the extreme of modeling, which is just absurd in my view. Mm-hmm. But so there is something about the entertainment industry where they kind of like, come here, and then you get slapped. I'm also a character actor, which is code for ugly. And so there is – I mean, when you read an audition where you're like auditioning his – you know, the lead's slightly awkward-looking friend. When you're auditioning for roles like that, you have – you get grounded. But,
yeah.
But it is – it's important to stay grounded, that's for sure.
Yeah. Courtney, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's go to Kent from Kansas City, Missouri. Kent, you're on Up to Date. Our guest today, Jim Gaffigan. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a huge fan, but I have to know, have you ever gotten threats or threatening letters or lawsuits from the Hot Pocket people?
No. That's
a good question,
Ken. You know, it's an interesting thing with the Hot Pocket thing because it, you know, first of all, Hot Pockets, it's not caviar, right? We know that people that are eating Hot Pockets are, you know, look, they're very busy. They're eating on the go. They're teenagers.
I think you may have just given them a new flavor of Hot Pocket.
Yes. But I think, you know, someone told me through the internet, so you know it was true, that Hot Pockets, they did a research study and they determined that I was actually helping sales. So they
that doesn't surprise me.
There were a couple of shows where Hot Pockets they had someone dressed in a Hot Pocket and they were passing out coupons.
And so
I had to say, you know, just you can't do that.
Yeah.
So it's the Hot Pockets thing is a blessing and a curse.
Ken, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
To what extent these days, Jim, at this point in your career, do you follow other comedians and sort of watch what they're doing, or do you very pointedly decide, nah, I better not go there because I don't want to rip off or copy or whatever. I'm doing my own thing.
Well, I've been doing stand-up for 300 years at this point.
Yeah.
No, over 20 years. And I think, I mean, I definitely know my point of view, so I wouldn't be influenced necessarily by someone. But, I mean, you know, you're always influenced by people. But, I guess I watch. It's great to see a friend's stand up, you know. But there is – it doesn't – you know, like I'm not laughing. I'm like, that's funny. That's good. That's good. You know what I mean?
So, you're sort of in a professional kind of frame of mind.
I do my show and kind of leave. I mean, I'm friends with all these people. I'd love to hang out with them, but I'm not dying to watch stand up. But I do, you know – think it's important. I mean, you're always learning things in stand-up and hopefully always getting better. I mean, that's what I really love about stand-up is I do feel like I keep getting better at it.
Who are the people you're watching these days? Who are the hot ones coming that you're sort of eyeballing and sort of interested in watching them grow?
Well, there's hot and then there's people that are really interesting. You know, I feel like stand-up has storytelling has had a big impact, and I don't know if that's influenced by podcasts or, but I don't know. Hannibal Buress is doing some pretty interesting things.
Do you guys know him? That ring a bell?
Yeah. But there's comedians that people probably don't know. I mean, Nate Bargatze's a really. Do you know who Nate Bargatze is? I think he's from Nashville, and he's pretty interesting. And so there's a lot of different things. But then I have friends of mine that are not necessarily famous. But Tom Papa he's doing great material about being a parent. And there's, and then there's other comedians like Ian Bagg, who's, I don't know if you know who Ian Bagg is. He's like amazing at crowd work. So there's different comedians that it's fun to watch them, but there's something, you know, I enjoy watching comedians because it encourages me to be braver, I think.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's not to say that, comedy's not brave, but some of why I did this book is because I always want my stand-up to appeal to everyone in the room. And so I think I intentionally censored myself in talking about parenting because I knew that as the 20-year-old watching stand-up comedy, when people would talk about their wife and kids or husband and kids, I would say, I don't care what you're talking about.
I don't
about.
Know that world.
So yeah. I would limit in my specials 5 or 6 minutes on parenting or being a dad. And then I think when I started to use Twitter a lot, I had an outlet for some of these small observations about parenting that I ended up turning into longer essays.
Yeah.
So Twitter probably had a big impact on me talking about parenting. But back to the comedians, it's bravery and it's also, being more open. I don't know. You know, sometimes I watch comedians and I go, wow, I thought that guy was better than
oh,
that.
Really? Yeah.
And then there are some people I watch and I'll go, wow, she's amazing. You know, that's really interesting what she's doing. Because there's bags of tricks that all comedians know, you know, to gain favor of the audience. Yeah. Like if you say, I support the troops, well, of course everyone supports the troops. I'm against racism. Well, of course everyone's against racism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's different ploys, and it's for me, it's tearing away some of that stuff. And I'm a very organized, probably over-organized writer, so sometimes it'll give me the bravery to just go up there and talk, and sometimes that's where some jewels come from.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's take a break. And speaking of Twitter, Jim's only got 1.7 million followers. We'll talk about some of his recent tweets. We'll talk about his new book, Dad is Fat. We'll take your questions too, 816-235-2888, and our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with the great comedian Jim Gaffigan. His new book is titled Dad is Fat. It's number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list this week. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 and our email address UpToDate@KCUR.org. He speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call our friends at Rainy Day Books for tickets, 913-384-3126. You know, before the break, Jim, I was mentioning that you've got nearly 1.7 million followers on Twitter these days. That's just amazing. I want to read some of your recent tweets, and sure, you can comment on some of them. One, I wish I hated pizza as much as pizza hates me.
Yeah, that's so... Oh, yeah.
This is my almost 2-year-old. There's a picture here. This is my almost 2-year-old with his head stuck in a potty chair.
Yes. Yeah.
I saw that picture.
Yeah,
what happened there?
That was it's like these portable things. But you know, you give a 2-year-old 30 seconds and they'll get in trouble. That's why as a parent, when you see a knife on a table, you're like, ah!
Yeah. Very poor parenting there, too, by the way, that a son stuck his head in a potty chair. What were people excited about before pretzel nubs filled with peanut butter?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Right?
That's a good one. And I absolutely love this one. My 4-year-old daughter just, I just couldn't believe this one. My 4-year-old daughter just asked her grandma, why do you have witch hands?
Yes.
it's good.
Unbelievable.
W-I-T-C-H. Witch hands.
Yes.
And kids think that.
Yeah, they just do this. There's no censoring. I remember as a kid, I had my aunt. My aunt was a big lady. And I asked her, why are you fat? And it's just unbelievable. I only remember because everyone in the room looked at me like, we're going to kill you right now.
And you knew something was very wrong. Yes.
Yeah.
I just had my daily favorite color conversation with my 4-year-old.
Yes. It's amazing.
Every day?
Every day. Well, I would say, you know, I'm exaggerating, but there's definitely these conversations. What's your favorite color? Then I'll ask her, and it's been green for 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, and she's 4 years old.
I like this one, too. My favorite part about making breakfast for my children is either the fact that they don't eat it or that I get yelled at for making a mess.
Yeah, there's just no winning. There's no winning.
I'm looking at two of them. I've been down this road 1,000 times. Why'd you make this? Well, I made it.
Then somehow it ends up where, at least with my wife, she's like, you made the eggs how you would enjoy them. I'm like, no, that's how everyone eats eggs. They're scrambled. But I accidentally put cheese in the scrambled eggs, which is, and granted, I enjoy cheese in my scrambled eggs, but everyone should. I'm trying to teach them healthy, well, not healthy eating, but how to eat.
Well, with Michael, anything green in an egg or on a sandwich is you've just committed, murder of first degree variety.
Some ways, I agree with him. Like when there's lettuce on a hamburger, I'm like, I'm not here for a salad. I'm here for meat.
Even one piece of lettuce on a hamburger.
Right. It's just, what's the point?
Yes. Yeah. Are we living in something of a golden age of comedy right now? You were reeling off all these names of these guys, and, you know, it's on TV all the time.
Yeah.
Have we reached something of a summit of life?
I think so. I think that we are in an era of a comedy boom, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think that there is, I mean, it's become mainstream. I know that's an ugly term, but I think everyone has, they're like bands. People have their own, depending on the type of mood you're in. Do you want to listen to Louis C.K.? Do you want to listen to Todd Berry? Mm-hmm. And there's something about discovering, and it's a personal relationship that you have, similar to how you feel with a band.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I feel awkward saying that because I'm just essentially a guy who tells diarrhea jokes for a living. But we are in a comedy boom. And when I started stand-up, it was after the end of the comedy boom. Like, when I started, there were all these shows on A&E and on cable that would just show kind of really mediocre stand-up comedy. But now I think we're in an era where there's something with the stand-up where it can speak to a lot of different types of people.
And yeah.
Everyone can have their own type.
Well, speaking of different types of people, you know, my son Nick is a fan of Louis C.K. And what strikes me about his routines, he is so brutally honest and forthcoming, and just an absolutely open book about some of the most personal things in his life that I almost can't imagine getting up on a stage and talking about some of the bodily things that sometimes Louis C.K. does. It just blows me away, and it works, but it's right. Just taking that step and exposing yourself to that extent. Wow, that's a whole different thing to me, it seems like.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the stand-up has this rich tradition that of dealing with censorship, a very strange, I'm an observational guy. I talk about minutiae, and there is a little bit of people like, you got to take on the government in your stand-up. And I'm like, well, or I could be a break from the cultural war that we're in right now. Between left wing and right wing.
Which I appreciate about what you do, by the way.
And I also think that comedians get a lot of credit for essentially just doing the type of comedy they would do. I think that, Louis Black should be yelling on stage. Mm-hmm. I think that I should be talking about food, that Chris Rock should be discussing the topics that he discusses. So therefore, I think comedians get a lot of criticism and compliments for the type of comedy they would do anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been doing stand-up over 20 years, and I've done, you know, when I started, I tried some political comedy, I tried some irreverent comedy, I tried hopping around on stage, and it's eventually you find your point of view. They say it takes 10 years, but you find where you fit and your personality. And there's it's similar to becoming an adult. It's like you want to, you gain a certain amount of confidence. It's like, all right, this is who I am. You know, I'm not, I mean, look, I love Dave Attell. I love his point of view. I love that he's irreverent and all these things. But that's what Dave Attell is supposed to be. I'm a guy from a small town in Indiana who doesn't really feel comfortable cursing in front of a room full of people.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, and I'm talking about, bacon. So maybe I don't need to curse when I'm talking about bacon. So it's all context, Brian.
Your humor, we're visiting with comedian Jim Gaffigan. Your humor is often described as family friendly. And you recoil from that phrase a little bit because of all the connotations that come with this idea of family friendly. But again, it strikes me it's so easy to walk down a different road and talk about sex and cuss like a sailor and do all that stuff. And you, very deliberately, it seems to me, you don't go there, at least not very often.
I used to curse more in my act. I don't really curse. Now but some of it is I got rid of it, selfishly, because when I was doing, sets on Letterman or Conan, I would have to take them out. And also, it's like if I'm doing an hour-long show, I have to follow my own jokes. So if I have a joke that's really blue, how do I talk about mini muffins after that? It's just imagine that in a conversation. It's difficult. But I don't know. I think that my comedy is the thing that I kind of find confusing about the clean comedy or the irreverent comedy is there's this romantic notion of the bad boy. And
yes.
I think it's a myth.
Yes.
Because the reality is I am a clean comic. I don't curse. You can bring your kid and not be embarrassed. But in the end, if it's not funny, no one's going. So if someone is filthy and funny, you're only going because it's funny. You know, it's like we're all adults. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like curse words are kind of funny. Shock is kind of amusing. But eventually it disappears. I mean, you know, irreverence like liberty is this moving thing. So what was irreverent during Lenny Bruce's era
yes.
is very vanilla now.
Yes.
So, you know, you can chase the irreverence and you can chase this romantic notion of brutal honesty, in my opinion, or you can focus on being funny and have some honesty in there. I mean, you know, the McDonald's joke, the thing I like about that joke is that it's, you know, the conventional wisdom is that fast food is bad. But again, we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
So railing against McDonald's is really nothing new. But if you point out that McDonald's is just another guilty pleasure like tabloid magazine
yeah.
or gossiping
mm-hmm.
or materialism, then it puts it in context. I mean, obviously, there are some negative things that are far worse. You know, it's like hate crimes are really horrible. That I'm not comparing it to that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that, you know, McDonald's is not as bad as our culture portrays it.
You
know,
so for you, not swearing, you don't have such a problem with swearing. It just didn't fit sort of where you wanted to go, if I'm hearing you right, Jim.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I think, you know, I am from the Midwest. And I remember when I moved to New York and I worked in advertising – and everyone was cursing all the time. I remember thinking it was very ironic that here were these creative people that were doing an F-bomb every other sentence. And some of it is – it's a cultural thing. It's like if you grow up in Brooklyn in the 70s, you're going to use it in a different way. I mean,
yeah.
Look, there's words that the British use that, like, they use it very casually, and it would make you cringe whether there was a woman in the room or whether you were by yourself.
Yeah.
So it's context. I don't know.
Jim Gaffigan is our guest, a great comedian. He appears tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books and Fairway for a ticket, 913-384-3126. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Grant writes us this on email, Jim. I can't decide if I want to move to L.A. and work my way up or stay in K.C. and get an education first. What's Mr. Gaffigan's view on education for writers and artists?
Well, I...
You got an education.
Yeah, I do a business degree, in fact, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Everyone's path is different, and I would say that there is no correct way to do it. And, you know, some people are discovered in soda shops, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You hear about that in movies. And some people sit in a small town in Illinois and they write some of the best novels, right? So I do believe that people are a product of their environment. So it doesn't matter where exactly you are, but who are your peers is probably important.
When did you realize in your life, when did you reach a point where you knew you were on the plane as a comedian that you wanted to be on? Was there a moment or was there sort of a period in your life where you thought, okay, this now feels right. I know where I'm going. The kind of humor I want to do is what I want it to be.
Well, I think for me, I was, you know, there's many generations in stand-up, right? There's like classes. And so there will be a group of comedians that have been doing it a certain amount of time. And the class above me was pretty and we're talking, you know, like they started 3 years before me or 4 years before me. But, you know, they were Louis C.K., Dave Attell, you know, Todd Barry, Mark Maron. And then in my class would be Judah Friedlander, Greg Giraldo. And so when but the point I'm getting to is I was the last of either of those classes to ever get to do a late night spot, which was really the watershed in people's careers mm-hmm. at that point. And I was the last one to do that. And there was, so we're going 5 years, me trying to get on Conan or Letterman. And I eventually came to the realization that I might never be on one of these shows. And therefore, you know, I, I have to be comfortable with the fact that I'm going to be a guy who just does stand up because he enjoys it and is going to do the type of comedy that I like. So instead of trying to impress all my peers by being dirty or being loud or being irreverent, I ended up getting quieter and whispering. And it wasn't, it was just kind of, again, I don't think I have any control over it. It's just kind of the type of stuff I'm supposed to do.
You know, Conan, Letterman, Leno, which one sort of discovered you first? And what do you remember about going on a national TV audience for the first time?
Well, definitely, you know, I'm from Indiana. So Letterman was, that was
the, he's from Indiana.
The goal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I did Letterman, which was my first late night show, again, 2 or 3 years after all my peers had done these late night shows, and I did my Letterman spot, and I got off stage, and the executive producer came up to me and said, "We'd like to develop a TV show for you." So there was this
no, really,
yeah, so there
that
was
quickly
this, you know, this once I had gotten detached from trying to have control over my career, then this moment just fell into my lap. And
was
once Letterman thought I was funny, then everyone else thought I was funny.
Was it because you were so good that night? You just hit it just right? Or
I think it was because I had not had an opportunity to be on one of those shows. I had like 3 more years in the minor leagues. So I was definitely ready. I was not thrown. I was not angry. I was angry. I was frustrated with where my career was going. And I had just gotten detached from, you know, I went through the, you know, different amounts of jealousy. And I was like, all right. And so then I was kind of centered and I was like, all right, this is, I'm doing it for me, you know, not to please expectations of where I should be.
And you were how old that night on Letterman, do you recall?
I was 102 years old. No, I was.
Every bit of it,
I think I was 30, 31.
That's not too old.
Yeah.
You hit it pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We have one more routine from Jim I want to play. This is Jim talking about one of his favorite foods again, bacon.
You want to know how good bacon is? To improve other food, they wrap it in bacon. If it weren't for bacon, we wouldn't even know what a water chestnut is.
Thank you, bacon. Sincerely, Water Chestnut III.
And those bits of bacon are like the fairy dust of the food community.
You want this baked potato?
Bring! Now it's your favorite part of the meal. Not interested in a salad? Bibbidi-bobbidi bacon! I just turned it into an entree. But once you put bacon in a salad, it's no longer a salad. It just becomes a game of find the bacon and the lettuce. It's like you're panning for gold. Eureka!
A penny for gold is about right. So at the end of the day then, Jim, you do this why? I mean, what was it about stand-up and comedy that hooked you and has driven you ever since?
I think there's something wildly addictive about the moment of creative fulfillment. Look, you're a writer too.
Yeah.
There's something of a moment where it's like, ah, and it's, you know, the endorphin swirl. There's you're creating something, even if it's just a small thing that it's just for you. It's, you know, look, I remember watching my mom needlepoint. She would get done with a needlepoint project and there was a satisfaction there.
Yes, yes.
Where it would be nice if other people acknowledged it, but there's really you know, when people talk about, like, it's amazing Bill Cosby still doing stand-up or Seinfeld went back to stand-up, it's, well, of course they did. It's incredibly fulfilling. You're on stage, you have a microphone, but really it comes down to creative fulfillment. And
you're talking more about the writing than the actual laughter, or
I think it's the writing. It's, you know, look, there's definitely something about being able to change the mood of another human being.
Yeah.
But by the way, there's nothing normal about going on stage and making strangers laugh. I mean, that's a pretty weird thing. But I don't know if it's the laugh. I think for me, it's the creating something, but definitely the feedback, the immediate feedback, because there is something about writing this book where Jeannie and I were working on it, and there was, looking for feedback.
Yeah.
And but when you're on stage, you can hear the feedback. You can hear where it's not clear. You can hear how funny they think it is.
Well, just for the record, this is the first time in 10 and a half years of doing this show. My kids are here with me this morning, and Aaron Branch, and this is Jim's the first guest that Dad's done something right here by having Jim here. They're with me here. They wanted to be here today, and thank you for being so gracious to them. And
thank you.
What a pleasure it's been, Jim.
Oh, sure.
Thanks
please.
For coming in.
This is
you
great.
Bet. That's Jim Gaffigan. His new book is titled Dad is Fat. He speaks at 7 p.m. tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Tickets, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the show, that 100 SPF sunscreen might not be as good as you think. A pair of dermatologists tell us about summer skin care. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Caitlin Brennan. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.